This is an interview of Mr. Ray Reeves, who lives at 4232 Buckingham in El Paso, Texas. The interview is taking place on Wednesday morning, February the 19th, 2003. The interviewee is Richard Baqueda. This is for the Bracero Oral History Project. So, Mr. Reeves, your name, please?
Raymond E. Reeves.
Reeves. And your birthday?
June 29th, 1923.
And you were born, was it here in El Paso? Where were you born?
I was born in the state of Missouri, and my mother's health wasn't very good, and the doctor advised that they go to a warmer, drier climate, so they moved to Alpine, Texas when I was 3 months old. So I was born and raised at Alpine.
And is that where you went to school?
Yes. Spent all my boyhood days down there.
In Alpine High School. How much education did you have?
Well, that's a long story. Things didn't go well. My dad he had a nice farm in Missouri when this event occurred. He sold it, and he spent every penny that he could get his hands on trying to save my mother's life, and she died when I was 4. And 2 years later, he married my stepmother, and she helped raise me, so I wasn't raised by a mother, but a good stepmother. I had no problems with that. She was very good. Just an old farm girl, no education, but well-schooled on how to run a household, how to cook, and all that. You know. So I grew up and started in grade school at Alpine. And my dad was a good, honest, hard-working man, but with no education. So he worked at 2 or 3 different jobs during the years that I was growing up, but none of them ever paid very well. So we were raised real, real poor. I grew up our home was about a mile north of town. And he had bought 2 or 3 cows, and we were selling a little milk. This is odd the way this came about. He was working for the Texas Highway Department at the time, and there was 2 or 3 individuals could see that he was making a little extra money in addition to his salary with them. So they began to complain and whatnot. And so one day the boss told him, the man in charge of the district, he said, Mr. Reeves, we're going to transfer you to Fort Davis come the first of the month, just to break up the little playhouse he had, making a few extra bucks and working his tail off. I was too. I was just old enough to
do it. Remember how much he made?
Just enough to pay the bills. Okay. I have heard them discuss, and I well remember this, the trouble they were having raising $12.50 a month for a houseboat. So that's how poor we were. We didn't have a vehicle. I walked and delivered, started in this dairy, walked in and delivered milk. It was a mile from town. Then he bought me an old secondhand bicycle, and my stepmother made me a canvas bag like a paper boy, and I'd fill that full of milk bottles and take off morning and night. And I got to where I was making 6 trips in the morning and 6 at night, so we were running. I had about 12 cows now, running a fair-sized operation, but a lot of work. And I wore out one bicycle, he bought me a new one. And by then we were doing better. And about that time is, that thing never rings.
Excuse me.
Okay, now I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And
so they told him that they were going to move him to Fort Davis. And
the highway department.
Right. And
he resigned. Oh. And rather new. And he come home and he said, well, we've got to get in the dairy business, I guess, because I just quit. And we knew that was a possibility. It wouldn't come as a shock to the stepmother and I. And, so he went down to the bank and talked to the banker, who was a very close personal friend of ours anyway, he and his family. I was raised with his boys, just like a brother. And let's see. the name was Crawford, and I guess it's his grandson, was just recently finished his doctorate at UTEP, and he's also a full-blown minister.
Oh.
And that's the kind of family they are. They've had their problems too, like everybody else. But they're pretty good sized family, but they were awfully good to me. They lived out there in the town, and they treated me like I was one of their own. And I've looked back on that for many years and treasured their friendship and still do, although Mr. and Mrs. Crawford had gone. Anyway, my dad, Mr. Crawford, told him, he was the banker. He says, "Earl, when you see a cow you want, just buy her and write a check. We'll take care of the check. Don't worry about it." But we didn't have any money. So, two or three cows at a time, and we wound up in.
What kind of cows were they?
Milk cows.
Oh, Jerseys. Jerseys, okay.
Yeah. And I got into athletics, and I was having a great time. And my dad knew how I respected and enjoyed that part of our being. And we'd hire some help when the ball season didn't come around, because I needed to stay at school after school for ball purposes, practice and whatnot. And then he decided he'd want me playing football.
Oh, football, okay.
Yeah, well, I'd play them all. Football, basketball, baseball. My dad used to play some semi-pro ball in Missouri when he was a young man growing up. So he was kind of strong on baseball. But I'm trying to get the events right. One day I told him, I was about 17. I said, "You know, there's no way you and my stepmother can do all this work, because I've got to get out of here." He said, "What?" I said, "Well, you know, war broken out in 41, and I was right in that vicinity somewhere. And I said, I'll be 18 a little while. I sure don't want to be a foot soldier. I want to fly." He said, "Well, I got news for you." I said, "What's that?" And he says, "You don't have to worry about anything." So I've been down to the draft board, talked to them, and they classify us as food producers, and you're eligible for a deferment. I looked at him and I said, "No, I can't do that." "What do you mean you can't do that?" I said, "Hey, everybody I've ever been around, all the boys, my friends, are all enlisted just like that. I'm going too." He said, "Well, you're going to ruin our business." And I said, "Well, Dad, that's why I'm telling you now, to give you some time, because I have to go, and I am going." He didn't like my determined attitude, you know. He thought he could sway me the other way. Well, I left under a kind of cloud of
he didn't want
dislike. To yeah, he didn't like it, but he got over it.
Were you the only one in the family?
Well, I had a brother 2 years older than I was, and I think I was 9 when this event occurred. He had a testicle lodged in the bottom of his stomach somewhere or another. And this is a lesson that we all, I think, could learn from. Alpine was a small town, and I think it had 2 doctors. And this one guy had examined my brother, and he says, "Oh, my wife's a nurse." He said, "We'd take care of that in just a few minutes." And he convinced my folks, as they say, we still didn't have any money. But that was the thing to do. So when they operated, they was using ether in those days. And the average amount of ether that you'd give that 12-year-old boy was 2 cans. Well, they're giving him the 5th can, and those are his dead.
Wow.
They just smothered him out. So that's why I don't have any brothers or sisters. I had one, but it didn't last very long. And he was a different type of individual than my dad used to. Told him one time, he said, "If you ever go off," his name was John Larvin, he said, "If you ever go off and Raymond gets beat up, taken up for you," he said, "I'm going to whip you again when you get home." Hmm. And every day, he's kind of a, I don't say a coward, it wasn't that strong, but he wasn't aggressive at all. You could get by him, mistreating him as, if you wanted to. And man, I'd just tie into them all day, where nearly all of them are older and I was bigger. So I learned to fight pretty good real young. I had an old friend, a blacksmith, and we had been to Sunday school this Sunday, and as I say, we didn't have a vehicle, it was just my brother and I was walking back. We had to go right by his house. About that time we encountered a couple of guys we knew real well, kind of a bully type, and one of them decided to whip John Martin, my older brother, because he just wouldn't fight. And the other guy said, well, I'll take on the little one. Well, he was about 2 years older and I wasn't quite a bit bigger, and I just whipped his butt to a fairly well. And this old blacksmith saw it start, and he was sitting in his living room looking out the window, and he thought, oh boy, I don't want that little one hurt. So he grabbed his hat and come running out. He tells this story. He said, by then your little boy had been knocked down twice, but he was up after him again, and directly he knocked that other down. I got skinned up a little bit, man. Yeah. But those were growing up days.
Yeah.
And
so you left home when about 17.
Yeah. 17. And that was about, well, I was born 23. I guess it was about 41 when things began
shortly
to pop.
After the
you
war.
Know, December 7th. So that'd be 42, I guess. 1942. And my experience was kind of hard for me to take, but you didn't have any choice. First thing I did, I had volunteered for the Air Corps to made a high mark, but I'd have just a little knee trouble. And I didn't say a thing in the world to him about it. And I got all the way through, and this guy says, you know, I better refer you back to the flight surgeon. He needs to look at you a little closer. Well, they flunked me out. He wouldn't take me. So I thought, well, I'll try again. So I think I took the second exam up here. I know I took one at San Angelo, one at Pecos, and one up here. So in the process of all that, there was a Navy V-12 recruiting team came into Sol Ross, and that's flying, you know, for the Navy. Yeah. They teach you to fly off of carriers. I thought, boy, this was just for me. So I signed up. And we had encountered a young fella from a town near San Antonio named Rodney Wheeler, who was real poor, and he was about a week ahead of registration for Sol Ross that fall. And I ran onto him downtown, and he was, well, you don't know where I can get a job. And I'm going to have to go home. I can't stay because I don't have any money. But I wanted to go to school this semester. And I said, I thought, I'll tell you what. Let me talk to my dad, and where can I see you tomorrow? And the upstart of that was, we hired him to help with the work at home for room and board. And that was it. More no money involved on either side. He didn't have to pay us, and we didn't have to pay him for his work. So that was a big help to him, and of course a tremendous help to us. Well, he went home and told on me for volunteering for the Navy V-12 unit. My dad thought we were home free, you know. I flunked two of those other exams by then. So he wasn't too happy with me. I didn't fare too well there for a few months, but I said, well, it's just the way it is. I can't live with myself if I don't. And so I got started. I took my ground school there at Sol Ross. They had a training unit there. So I was ready to go into primary flight training. Had to go through another physical when they flunked me out again on my knee. After
what
all
was,
that.
What was the problem with the knee?
I tell you now, you say, I don't believe you. It hurt a little and swelled a little, and living in a little town like that, the doctors in those days weren't half what they are today. But nobody got very excited about it. I thought, let's get along all right. But When they really begin to give you a close examination, I guess I wasn't doing that well, but they wouldn't take me. So then I went over to Marine Corps. I didn't get to first base. You're 18 years old. I said, yep. Why aren't you in the service? And I said, well, I'm trying to get in the service. And they didn't like that answer, you know. And they wouldn't listen to me at all. I didn't make the Marine. And I thought, well, I guess I'll wind up in the Army. And my time came, and they wanted to know why I was about 18 and a half by then. Why I hadn't been drafted before. I had to explain all this to them, and they said, we don't want you to. So I didn't even get in the service. You know, I got my basic training and my basic flight training ready to go, start my flight training. That's as far as I got.
Just that, was it because of the knee?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And this old knee today has been replaced twice. Total replacement in the name of the hoop.
And you never figured out why, since you that young, whatever?
No.
Maybe you bruised it or hurt it or something?
No, they never did. No. Come up with a solution. But it's been operating on about four times. And see the old marks up through there?
Yeah.
One of them that went exactly right over, and there's a guy here, doctor, I would recommend him to anybody. Hernandez, Alvaro Hernandez, he's real good. I went to him a while back because I limp a little, about 6-8 months ago. He's operating on every member of our family for something or another. And I've known him a long time, you know. And sat down and he says, what's your problem, Ray? And I told him, he says, can you straighten that out? And I said, sure. You have any pain? I said, no. It's just weak, I think. I just wanted something we could do to it to make it a little better. He says, how old are you? I said, 79. He says, goodbye. Somebody else said, Ray, you should go to another doctor. And I said, I was pleased with, I know him real well. I know how good he is and how honest he is. And I just didn't have any hankering to go to another doctor. Yeah. Well, that's a story that doesn't fit what you want, what you need.
Well, so they wouldn't take you in the military. You stayed home?
Let me think a minute. I stayed home about a year. And during that time, you can tell I was athletically inclined about everything. Herbert Coconut, and this is a fantastic story. I could write you a book on this one, but I'll shorten it along. He's a rich rancher.
Is that the man the field is named for down there?
Exactly. He's dead now. But he was wealthy, wealthy, wealthy. He built Coconut Field, which is the nicest minor league ballpark in the United States.
That's what I've heard. In Alpine, right?
In Alpine. My name was in a gold plaque they had on the wall. Well, our team, not just me. But I was on the team and my name was. And I was kind of proud of that. But I played for him 2 years and I had to quit. And there's been several major leaguers come through his little organization down there. He'd play anybody that wanted to play, you know. And the funny thing about him, of course, he did, like I say, he just had money running out of his ears. He paid you good.
How much?
$600 a month. All your expenses away from home.
This would be just for the baseball season?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he'd bring guys in there. He had people that scouted for him, so to speak. And he'd bring young fellows in to Saul Ross. And he'd pay all their expenses. And then come springtime, it was his, you know. To make it.
Where did he make his money? Do you have an idea?
Yeah.
Just a rancher?
No. He owns, and his estate, I guess, still owns nearly the entire property from Alpine to...
What was the name? The name again?
The entire property from Alpine on the right of the road to Balmoray, right through the Davis Mountains.
I thought you mentioned a name. I didn't catch the name.
It's Coconut, so Herbert Coconut.
That's it.
And everybody liked him. And he had a peculiar, he was well thought of and well liked in that town. He had a peculiar characteristic about him. He and his wife didn't see eye to eye. They didn't divorce, but they didn't live together. And she, of course, she just lived the life of Riley because he's a millionaire. And traveled all the time. And nobody really resented any of that because he never even looked at another woman that was married. And he had his girlfriend, but she was divorced. And anytime anybody in that town needed anything, Herbert Brookman would take care of it. I remember the war was just about over. And they'd built a new VFW, a small town, it wasn't a huge thing, but a new VFW hall for the guys coming back from overseas from to dance and drink and raise hell, and that was what they was doing, and they was making so much noise that the neighbors began to complain, and old Coconut was built it and gave it to them on his land. And I remember our pep squad girls in high school was getting, they put together a little plan to work and make some money and buy some pep squad uniforms. He found out about it and just bought them. And that, he's that way about everything. Very charitable person. And never wanted any praise or nothing. He just leave me alone. And anything he needed, anybody needed, old Herbert would take care of it. And a great man, so many ways. And I respected him after I got grown and you could see these problems develop in marriages and so forth. I've always respected the fact that he never bothered nobody. He took his own likes and dislikes as far as his a woman is concerned. Old Babe Garnett was her name.
It's nice looking woman. It's interesting that the army, the military, wouldn't accept you because of the knee, but you could still play.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I played ball. I put together
what ball. Position did you play?
Well, I used to, I pitched a little, but I wasn't a very good pitcher. But I used to play shortstop. And later, when the knee got a little worse, I played first base. But I was a pretty good hitter. Even with a darned old knee, I could hit that ball.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you travel around much?
Yeah, we traveled some. Not extensively, but we'd go to different towns. And we went into Mexico twice. No, wait a minute. I'm wrong. We did, but not with Coconut. I was got in the Border Patrol, and he talked to my dad and tried to get my dad to, which, of course, no problem, not let me in the patrol so he could keep me on his team.
Oh.
But he and I got along real good, Coconut, and I said, well, I don't think I can make a career out of it, and maybe I can on this other. So I've got to look out for old Ray Reeves, you know. So I said, no, I really love to play. You've been real nice to me, and I've no problems, except I'm doing what I think would be best for me in the long run. Because I said, you know, this is a short-lived thing.
Sure.
And he's brought through some good major league, that developed into major league players through his organization. I had an old catcher one time. He was a baseball coach at Texas A&M. We had him 2 or 3 years. I really liked him. He was a fun guy. One time he got off from home down there out here to play on the weekend, left his baseball shoes. Well, mine fit him, and I wasn't going to play. So I loaned him my shoes. We had a lot of fun. A lot of things like that happened. But he was not a loser. He built this nice stadium and all, and every once in a while some jerk would come in from somewhere else and they'd get up in that stand, you know, and they'd go to yelling against the Alpine Cowboys. And old Coconut, go get them. He'd be up there, you know, he said, if you can't yell for our team, we don't need you, you can go. Get out of here. He ran off, not a lot, but a few people, I don't know, because of that. But you'd get behind and you'd need a hit real bad or a strikeout real bad, and he'd tell the pitchers, $25 for another strikeout. Tell the guy, the hitter coming up, we need a base hit to know pretty bad. $25 for a base hit, and it wasn't boom. He'll pay you just like that.
How much for a home run?
I don't know. I hit a few of them, but he never did the, I guess it wasn't in one of those tight, but it never, he was paying us $600 a month, which was a lot of money in those days.
Sounds like it, yeah.
And this is a great fun. And then when I got the patrol, I put together a ball team myself.
How did you get into the Border Patrol?
Well, it's a strange coincidence. My life's full of funny things, so different. One of these people that I was delivering milk to, I got along with everybody real good there. Good people, good to me. One day he says, "Ray, you don't want to do that all your life, do you?" And I said, "I don't have any choice." He says, "What if I gave you a choice?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Hey, the Border Patrol's hiring men right now. You'd make it good." And he said, "Pay good? And you'd like the work? I know you that well. And why don't you go in there and talk to them?" And I said, "Okay." So I went down there and talked to them and hired just like that on what they call a temporary appointment. I didn't have a permanent
status.
That
was there in Alpine?
Yeah. The headquarters were there. I used to deliver milk to some of those guys, and the chief and all. I never thought I'd be one of them.
One of them.
It was fun. And
did you have to go to any training school?
Oh, yeah. It was in El Paso at that time.
So first it was temporary, but how did it become permanent?
That was 45 when I went in, March 1st, 45. And they gave the first exam in 48 for a permanent position. And I didn't feel bad at all the way I was treated at that time, because I felt that a guy that would go into the military, go overseas, certainly had the preference. I had no problem with that. And I just thought, maybe I could squeeze in there somewhere. And they began hiring them back when they come back from overseas. It was in the patrol when they left. They'd leave the patrol and go overseas, or go in the service. And that's what happened when we got into 49. I got a letter one day explaining all this, and I had no points. If you've been to service, you get 5 points on your exam, or if you've been disabled in any way, you get 10. And those guys were coming back. I made a pretty good grade, but I didn't get anything added to it. So. They turned a bunch of us loose. I was turned out in 49. And with the advice that we don't know, but we may can take you back later. Well, I went to work. You can't just sit around, you know.
No.
And let's see, what was my first job? It's going to tie into your program in a minute.
Oh, that's okay. It's tying in already.
I'm not sure I can give you the right sequence.
You didn't go back to work for your dad?
No. No. I went to work. Well, when I was in patrol, and here it comes back, I was transferred one time from, well, I started in Sanderson, and I was only there 3 months, and I'll tell you why in a minute. And I was transferred to Presidio, and I just loved it, and I had a good time down there.
Okay.
And so I took the first exam they gave. I said I didn't get any points at it, like the rest of them are nearly all. I made 88, and they told me at the time, they said, "Well, that's not bad grade, you. They'll probably reach you some of these times on the register." And they did. They called me back, and I had to go through probation again, go through the training school again. I didn't have any problem. I could do that in my eyes closed. But for a boy that's a man, that a lot of those things are stranger to him, Spanish and immigration law, why, it's hard.
Did you have to study the immigration law? Were you already familiar with it?
Well, that's funny. It goes back to when I came in. They called me in March 1st, 1945, and they sending me to Sanderson. I didn't even have a car that'd take me down there. And from Alpine, at headquarters. And they said, there's two officers stationed at Sanderson, and you're to work with a young one named Jack Williams. There's an old man, he's going to retire pretty quick, and we'd rather you didn't work with him. So that's the way we want it set up. Okay, do the best I can. And I've looked back on that and I thought, what a mistake they made, sending a young, like 21 years old, inexperienced, raw kid into a situation where there's a lot of controversy between the two men. You couldn't do right, you know. If you worked with the old man, which I didn't, I liked him, got along with him fine. And the other guy was kind of a party guy. He was from Amarillo, his home. I'll never forget him. And I'm a teetotaler, and my wife is too, and we never drank anything, never partied. And this guy, every once in a while, his wife would go home to Amarillo, and boy, he'd party while she was gone. And one time, he and another guy went to Vicuña across from Del Rio and partied for a day or two and drank, raised the devil. He told me where he was going. He said, "Ray, I don't want you to tell anybody unless the office in Alpine calls." Tell more on that. That's all. It's okay. So I tried to get along with him. I didn't tell a soul. I wasn't asked, so I didn't tell anybody. And I had this friend, like I told you, I used to deliver milk to these border patrolmen there in Alpine. And he and I, an older guy, we got to be good friends. And he's the one that told me, "Hey, come down there, it's a good job, maybe you can get on." And when I got on, he says, "Boy, am I glad for you." And I said, "Oh, I appreciate that." And he said, I want to help y'all with camp. I said, "Here." And he gave me a 25 typewritten pages of law, immigration law. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a car. And I wanted the job real bad, as you can see, didn't have nothing. And when he gave me that, I sat and studied, and I studied. And my days off, I'd study. And it wasn't 2 or 3 months till I could quote that whole 25 pages. And that's a lot of law.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. So this guy, he turned a bad report in on me that I wouldn't party with him. That wasn't what he put in the report, of course, but he told him I wasn't studying. So the first time I was in headquarters, this chief called me and he says, "What's this I hear about you not studying?" And I said, "Well, I'm studying." And he says, "You studying?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, how much do you study every day?" And I told him. I never did tell him about that outline I had. I said, "I study on my days off. I don't have anywhere to go. I don't have a vehicle. So I have nothing else to do but study. So I study all day, every day. My days off." And I said, "If we don't have too long a day, I study at night." And I said, "Sometimes we're gone 15, 16 hours. And I don't study that night. But most of the time, I'm studying 2-3 hours a day, plus my days off." And he said, "Well, that's quite a bit of study, Ray." And I said, "Yes, sir, I've been working hard." And he says, "Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do." He says, "You know, we've got several trainees, that's what they call you when you go in, over the sector, and that's the whole different stations that compose the Alpine sector." And he said, "Some of them's exams are coming up." And he said, "I need to go around and review with them anyway to see how they're doing." And he said, "I'll be down here in a few days and give you a test, and I can tell where you studied or not." I says, "Fine." I wasn't afraid of his dadgum test. I knew. But he couldn't give me a test I couldn't pass. So he gave me this test and I finished it. He called me back, he graded, called me back in. He says, "What do you think you made?" I said, "Oh, I didn't miss too much. I wouldn't commit myself." And he said, "No, you didn't." He said, you missed 2 points. And he says, "I gave you, you haven't even been in but about 2 months. I gave you the hardest immigration law exam that I could give you, and that we give our boys for their final in 10, after they've been with us 10 and a half months." And he said, "You've been in here too, and you make a grade like that." He said, "I'm amazed." He said, "Don't worry about anything, I'll take care of it. Good luck to you." Took off. Boy, the first time I was in headquarters, they said, "Come in here, Mr. Reed, need to talk to you." Chief did. I guess I'll give it a hasty or something, you know. And he said, we'll discover you've done remarkable job so far, and we're real proud of you, and we want you to transfer you to Presidio." I said, "How long will it take you to get ready?" I said, "Well, it'll take about 2 hours to get back to Sanderson about an hour for me to get my stuff ready and another 2 hours to get back. He could laugh. He said, I didn't mean it like that. He said, days or whatever it takes, don't rush. But whenever you're ready, let us know and we'll move you. It wasn't but a few days till they moved me to Presidio. I just went like a house of fire down there. I liked the work.
What was it that you did?
We'd go out in those days and camp out there four or five days out in the boondocks somewhere.
Really?
You know, on trails that the illegals used coming in down okay. that area.
So that's all you were looking for was just illegals?
Well, we were authorized under the law to take any action on any customs violation of smuggled merchandise.
Right.
And we did a lot of that. And of course, I was still on temporary appointment. You know, I wanted to make good grade. I wanted to make them a hand so I could, when the time should arise somewhere where I'd get a shot at a permanent job. You know, I just felt that all the way along. And I didn't see how they could turn me down when I'd studied hard and knew as much as I knew. And I didn't have any trouble with Spanish.
What I was going to ask you, did you know Spanish? You were fluent in?
Yeah, I was pretty good. Not real fluent at that time. But a lot of my friends were Mexican-American guys. And we was on ball teams together, and I could pick up a lot of stuff from them. Some of you and more here.
Right.
It was fun. And I wasn't real fluent, but I knew some Spanish when I came in. And, of course, they teach you Spanish. That's part of your training school. It's a rough go. Anybody hadn't had any Spanish for a boy and the law. And then there's first aid and naturalization and elementary criminal law and court procedure. There's a number of courses that you're pretty well rounded out when you get that year in, because at the end of 6 months, and I don't think they've changed this even that far back. I don't think they've changed this today even. At the end of 6 months, well, they might give or take a few days, but generally that's the way they phrase it. They'll give you a major exam in both law and Spanish and call you before a reviewing board and give you this law and Spanish. Well, naturally, I never did tell them I knew very much Spanish, but I never had any trouble with it. And so I breezed right through that and learned all that law. I could quote you a lot of law, and somebody tell me what that meant or how to use it, I could tell them. But I could
quote it, what
the book said.
So you were in Presidio what year, do you remember?
Yeah, I went to Presidio in 45 the first time. It's coming along. I was back the second time. And I stayed till 48. And up the river from Presidio, there's a place, a little town called Rio Doce, just like New Mexico. It's real small. They had a post office, mostly used for farmers and ranchers in that area. Most of those people were Mexican American guys. And I got along with them. I was raised with them. My father would get along with them. Real good. We called it a camp, but it was actually a Quonset Victory Hut. Hmm. And we'd be assigned up there with a partner for about a week at a time every once in a while when it came to your turn. And most of those boys could cook pretty good. I couldn't when I started, but I could when I finished. Not good, but I could make out of it. And about that time, they opened up a lot of new land up at Pecos. Just thousands of acres. They discovered that was a good place to raise cotton. And a lot of water.
The water, is it from underground?
Yeah, they drilled about 200 feet. And they had wells running out your ears and gas pumps everywhere. So one day I was talking to one of those farmers, and I asked him about the gas supply. I said, where do you guys get all that gas for these pumps? He said, oh, we got a big contract with, I think if I remember right, it was a company called Del Norte Gas. And we got a big contract with them. They furnished us all right at a very reasonable price. Yeah. Well, that's great, but I said, how long is that contract good for? He said, 4 years. And I said, well, how about, is it worded where it's automatically renewed? Oh, no, we got to do it all over again. I said, man, all the investment everybody's making in this thing, that's not very good business in my book. I said, it looks to me like you guys, when you put this thing together, he should have had in the contract that it's automatically renewable, or at least in a way you can renew it even if they raise the price low. You didn't do that, did you?
No.
By George, I was right. After a few years, they raised the price of that gas, natural gas, so much. There's big homes out in that big 20 or 30 miles from town of Pecos, nice places. And a lot of money invested in all of that cultivation and getting that ground ready for cotton. Big, big operation. Thousands of acres, all through there, Barstow, down to Gomeray, put up to this way away is about 40 miles. And sure enough, that company just doubled. Well, their contract, the end of it.
The price?
Broke them. Hmm. It's real heartening, sick to flower the area now, if you knew what it was like a few years back. Boy, it was green and everybody was busy and working and lots of workers and lots of money. The place was good, great place. And it's raising cantaloupe. You've heard of the Pecos cantaloupe.
Oh, yeah.
It's good. They had that industry going too, along with all that cotton. And I'm no country boy at heart. And one time I was working on a police department. I had a good partner. We played tricks on people, you know. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. One time we caught a wet way and then I'd done something. And there's another two policemen that would work in their car, and we'd work an hour, we had two cars and prowl all night. And one of us would sit by the telephone. We didn't have radios that would work in those days. So one night I said, and one of the other guys was a big old guy, but he had one bad eye. Wingo, I'll never forget it. And the guy, and the size and all, he was afraid of the shadow. Huh. You couldn't believe that, working a job like that. So I said, we'll have some fun, I'm a Wingo. So this wet had a blanket and an old, big old straw hat, you know. And so I told him, I said, I'll give you a couple bucks. Loan me your blanket and your hat and hide in the back seat. And I'll get back to you in a little bit. Okay. So I picked that old hat. And he had stolen the bicycle, that's how come I stole it. And I got on this bike and turned on the light and started down the street. Here's old Wingo parked over there where he's supposed to be, you know, him and his partner. And I go by and I honk that air horn a couple of times. Hola, hola! The old Wingo, he couldn't believe a crazy Mexican to be doing that at that hour of the morning, you know. Oh, he had a lot of fun. And then one night, we got a report they'd broken into a restaurant. So we surrounded the place, and I guess we boogered them all. There was a ladder up the wall, and it was a stucco wall. I'll never forget this crazy Wingo. And I told my partner, I said, let's see how good a Wingo is on something like this. I said, watch this. And so I go over the ladder, and Wingo's walking in this alley, not too far from the ladder. And I shoved it, and against that stucco wall, I go, choo, 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 you know. Oh, okay. The old Wingo didn't even look around. He said, whoosh, took off. I don't think he stopped for two blocks. And I'll tell one more on Wingo, and then we'll get on to business. His partner and my partner would be off at 4 o'clock in the morning, and that would throw the other guy, his partner, and myself, would be partners from 4 o'clock till 8. And we hadn't hardly got together, Wingo and I, one morning about 4 o'clock, till I can't remember if it was a call or whether it was
this morning or afternoon.
Morning. Yeah. Real early in the morning. We worked at midnight 8. Whether we got a call or whether somebody stopped by and told us. But anyway, so there was a car pulled into filling station up there on the edge of Pecos, with dust and dirt all over it, been stored somewhere. So we're almost sure it was stolen at that hour of the day. I said, well, how long ago has that been? He said, just a few minutes ago. It can't be far. He was gassing it up. So I told my partner, we go. I said, let's go. So didn't have the freeway in those days, Highway 80. So we went up to the gas station. They said, ask me which way you went when you left. And they told he's heading toward El Paso. So we took out Highway 80, you know, and we'd gone probably 10, 15 miles. And like two taillights come into view in front of us. So we'd caught up with him nearly. About that time, when Wingo was driving, about that time I felt this car begin tires begin to slow down, you know. So I glanced over there at the foot feet, and he let it up. He was scared of his shadow, the man was. He had no business doing that work at all. And directly he said, I didn't say anything. I thought, God damn, what's he doing? So directly I said, something wrong with the car, Wingo? No, why? I said, looky, that guy's pulling away from us.
He didn't want to catch him.
And I said,
do you remember his name?
Wingo was up in my, but no, I don't remember the guy that allegedly stole the car.
No, I mean Wingo's name. You just know him.
Blakely.
Wingo. Okay.
Yeah. So I said, well, look, Wingo, we're not going to catch him this way. I said, why don't you pull over and let me drive and I'll catch him. And he did, and we caught him. And in the meantime, I reached under the dash and pulled out a big old spotlight, unbuckled my pistol, and I said, I'm ready, we'll get him. Oh, he was scared. He was afraid we were going to get him, all right.
Wow.
He shouldn't have been in there.
How much longer was he in the Border Patrol?
Well, he wasn't in the patrol. He was city police.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I was working with city police at that time.
Oh, okay.
That was the time, the period of time that I was waiting on the exam to be announced, and
I
had to make a living.
Okay.
I had a good job when I came back, and I hesitated a little bit. And they had a board of directors on this, what they call the Trans-Pecos Cotton Association, and they ran the whole thing, had an office, a couple of secretaries. It was a big operation because you had several thousand up there all the time.
This was in the Alpine Police Department?
No, it was Pecos.
The Pecos Police, yeah. Okay. Police Department.
And then I went to work for this Cotton Association, and that was a job right down in my alley, you know. Well, the other was too. I had a lot of fun. Because I had a good partner who was always pulling something on somebody, you know. And he was a jovial type individual.
So but, how did you hear about the Bracero, the first time you ever heard?
Well, when I was in Pecos, there were wets running everywhere when I was transferred up there. And when we tied into that situation, trying to bring it under control. And it began to hurt the farmers, of course. They needed cotton pickers. And the melons, same thing. You see, I think that's all I can remember. I think somebody raised a few watermelons. But mostly cotton. There's thousands of acres of good cotton. They're making a mint. And I got to talking to one of these board of directors one time. He and I were big buddies. I said, doggone, look at the money people are making in this. I said, if I had the money, I'd buy me not a lot because I don't have the time, but I keep my job with you guys. Yeah, maybe 30, maybe 50 acres somewhere, and I'll make some of this money too. I'll raise me some cotton. He said, Ray, he's president, vice president one of a bank there. He said, anytime you want to do that, just let me know and I'll raise some money for you down to my, okay, your own. And he was a farmer himself, so he knew his business. He said, I said, well, I never rode around cotton before. He said, don't matter, I'll help you. I'll guide you. If you want to do that, I'd like to see you make some money. So I was all kind of set. They bought me a pickup, this company had. I called it a company. And my job, of course, was taking care of the braceros. If you was a farmer and you needed 40 for a month, why, I'd get you 40 legals with what we called an I-100 loan. It fit in your billfold, small card with your picture on it. But it was proof that you were an agriculture worker.
Right, and not an illegal, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Do you remember what year this was?
Well, just a minute. Well, when I went up to Pecos in 48, that program had not commenced yet, so it must have been 50, 51. I'm guessing now. I could be off. And
so you still weren't in the Border Patrol?
Yeah, I was in.
What you were?
I was called back in 50.
Okay.
Just about a month before my year was up, and I didn't bother my sick leave. Couldn't use it anyway. I wasn't sick, you know. But when I was called back, they let me keep accumulated sick leave when I went back in the second time. So I wound up when I retired with 3,600 hours of sick leave. And in those days, they didn't pay you for it, and they don't today, I don't think. But, and it's used to, you just lose it. That's
yeah.
it.
Right.
But they passed a regulation, and this was before I retired, that they take that sick leave, like if I had the 40 years service and a year and a half of sick leave accumulated, I'd get credit for 41 and a half years.
Oh.
That added 2 years. Time.
Well, that's better than losing
oh,
everything.
Yeah, it was great. I got a check one day for $14,000. I'd retired. My wife come home, she'd still teach it. I said, look what I got in the mail today.
Wow.
She said, well, what's that for? I said, I don't know. Well, what do you mean you don't know? And I said, that's all I got. I said, there'll be a letter in here some of these days. So what are you going to do with it? You better send that back so you don't get in trouble. I'm not going to get in trouble. They mailed it to me. And she said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to put it in the bank. I'm going to see what happens. I said, we'll get a letter someday. And sure enough, a couple of weeks, here comes a letter of explanation. And is it sick leave?
Uh-huh.
So that worked real good. And then it's customary, and I'm sure they still do this. Like if I know that I'm going to retire in November of this year, and let's say we're in January of this year, I won't use any of my vacation time, and that's 26 days. Because when you retire, if you've got any accumulated time, you get paid for it. So I got another check, or that was the first one really. This is $12,000 and so I come out when I retired with two checks, $26,000.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good for an old poor boy.
Yeah, that's true. So you were like you were bringing the braceros to the farms?
Well, way the association, Trans-Pecos Cotton Association, was set up, and they had these scattered all up down in the country.
I see. Did they come to a certain place?
Yes, the braceros? They had a center.
Right.
And like if you was a farmer and you wanted the 50, because your crop would be due in, say, October, November for cotton stock picking. And you wanted 50, you come into my office, place your order, and I'll have your people ready for you.
So you would go and pick them up at the...
Well, they'd bring them. I didn't have to. They'd bring them down on buses.
Oh. So you personally didn't, like, pick them out? Somebody...
No.
Okay.
Yeah. And the farmers at first, the ranchers more than the farmers, complain about, hey, we're having to take people. We don't know whether they can pick peanuts or what,
right.
You know? And they said, well, that's just the way it is. If they don't know, bring them back in and we'll try to get you somebody else. Or maybe you want to train them a little, work with them a little bit and keep them along. And that worked real well. We didn't have any trouble at all. But getting into this program, they set up three big screening centers, one in Monterey, and one in Chihuahua, and one in Hermosillo, when they drew up this international treaty that started the Brochelle program. And these
the
reason
formalized it?
Yeah, that was the beginning step. You, as a person that wanted to become a Brochelle, you report to one of these centers. And who worked in those centers, you'd get a report every few days about how many you needed. And we'd process them and then ship them up to processing centers. Now here, you're aware, I'm sure, of this place. It's the sheriff's training posse.
The Rio Vista?
That's it.
Right.
That used to be an old training for sheriff.
So they would come from Chihuahua, Hermosillo, or Monterrey to one of these centers, like the Rio Vista here?
Right. And they'd finish the process. And down there, I got sent down there three times. You'd interview these people because The guy, maybe he's a barber. Well, you ain't gonna make a farmhand. But he wanted to get into the States, so he'd try to propose himself to be a, present himself to be a bracero. And we had checked their fingerprints, you know. And
so how did you end up, you ended up at one of these centers in Mexico? Yeah. How was that, how did that happen?
Oh, I was a border patrolman, and they staffed them all with border patrolmen, the three big centers.
So these are in Mexico, but they're run by the U.S. government, or both together, or?
Yeah, together. They'd, they'd I guess they're, with them, they'd be their first step at Corsagis to Morelia type thing.
And you, which one were you? You were at
Chihuahua.
In Chihuahua. How did you get there? Did you
drove?
You drove there.
They pay you mileage.
I see. But you were being
fair to me.
Still being paid by the Border Patrol, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what did you do?
Like, there's usually probably from four to six of us, and we all had a little desk, so to speak, and we'd interview them. Try to determine their background, if they would make a suitable agricultural worker here in the States. And they'd try to fool you, you know. They'd falsify these little Mexican documents and change the pictures.
So you would ask for documents, or like proof of age or something?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Was there a certain age requirement?
I don't think so. I don't think the age had anything to do with it. As far as that goes.
So it was just sort of an identity.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And these guys tie everything in the world, you know. Like a barber would come in there, well, he'd know how to pick cotton, you know, but he, oh yeah, I'm a bracero, I'm a farm worker. And you talk to him a few minutes, first thing you know, you find out he wasn't a farm worker. You look at these prints. Well, those old boys that really work in agriculture, on fingerprints, you could not. They'd wear all the ridges off your fingerprints.
Calluses and
So we'd have these guys' fingers about like mine are now.
So you would check their hands?
Yeah, we'd check their hands, and of course talk to them. And it's kind of a fun job. And every once in a while, you'd run onto some old. We used to the very first time I went down there, we fingerprinted everybody, and. Their hands were so bad that you wouldn't get any legible prints, hardly, percentage-wise. They finally canceled that out.
Why was the fingerprinting done?
All trying to identify them. And they'd be shipped up to an area, an office. The fingerprints would be. Well, actually, they'd go to the FBI first and be classified.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Trying to identify any criminals.
You didn't. So you would just check their papers, talk to them about...
an agricultural worker.
You didn't ask them any other questions, you didn't check like for medical conditions or anything, that was done somewhere else?
We had a doctor, if we had any reason, we could refer him to the doctor.
I see.
So, mostly it was an interrogation type thing.
I see. And did you have many of them show up, lots of them showed up?
Oh, yeah. They're hungry, and no jobs. And still that way today, it works probably. And they'd do anything in the world to get into the country. And that was the way to get in, the easiest way for them to get in those days.
Where did you stay when you were there? In a hotel?
A nice hotel. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. My wife came down and stayed a while one time. And she said, I'm going home. took off. She said, not for me.
You don't remember where it was, where your office was in Chihuahua, an address or anything in Chihuahua?
Well, to be honest with you, no. I think I could take you to it, but I can't tell you a number or anything.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
So how many you would work every day, six days a week? Or?
Yeah, every once in a while, you know. You get orders from up here all the time. And you get those orders, they give you enough time, you know, like if you needed 1,000, well, you could get through with them maybe in 4 or 5 days, and if you didn't get any more orders, you'd be have a little extra time there.
So you could do a couple of hundred or so a day?
No, let me think. I can't do that many and do a halfway decent job. But we'd play tricks on one another. I know one time there's an old boy that had arthritis. We were still printing them in those days. They'd line up to your desk, you know. And you get to where you just reach around and get him. Old boy never even look back, you know, and pull him on up to his prince. Well, they set this one up on me. And of course, they're all watching. I didn't know anything. He did it all over. And so I reached, I got this old boy, these arthritic hands, you know, the more you print him, the man, the moon, you know. And a lot of them would be nervous, you know, and they'd be tightened up, and you'd afloja la mano, hombre, hombre. Andale, no va a pasar, sino afloja la mano. Okay. So I talked to this old boy two or three times, and he had a finger, you know. And I'd already pulled him up there, and I'd touch him. And everybody's about to flip. They thought that was really funny. I didn't think he was so funny.
No, I bet he didn't either.
No, I wasn't twisting him. I wasn't hurting him, but I wasn't getting the job done at all.
So they would be behind you?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
A line up behind us.
Oh.
Yeah, and then the
and they would come up
Mexican immigration service would run the center, and they'd furnish us the people.
Right.
And then we'd do our part in the building.
So you would fingerprint them, and then what? They would come around in front of the desk, and then that's where you talk to them? Is that how?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you have clerks or typists there who would? They were probably Mexican workers, right?
Yeah. I never did encounter really a poor hand in that capacity.
How long were you there at that center?
Well, if they sent me to Chihuahua tomorrow, and we had orders down there for, say, 2,000, and it'd keep you several days before you could get that many. And once you got caught up and got these orders filled, they might send you home. There's a guy in charge, one of our people in charge of that part of it. And if you caught up and orders weren't coming in and all, they'd send you back home. They had that prerogative. Yeah, that's all right. Don't have wrong with it.
And then I just assumed that maybe you would stay there for several weeks or
two. Yeah, we did. We stayed there most of the time. I stayed about 6 months. But the reverse also happens. You get down there and get to work, and boy, the orders come in and begin to stack up, you know, and you'll get way behind. They'll send some more people down there, Border Patrol agents down there. You might start out with 4 or 6, and you might wind up with 10 or 12.
Oh, I see.
For a while, till you caught up and things.
Do you remember which months of the year was it when it was heavy?
Oh,
do you
remember? A little bit before
the
fall,
harvest. Yeah, I see.
Cotton picking time. Now, of course, I keep bringing this cotton picking thing up. There's centers. They sent these braceros. We supplied Colorado, of course, New Mexico, Texas. The western part of Texas, Nebraska, with the workers. Now, other centers like at Hermosillo, they'd supply California. Man, that's a big agriculture area.
In Arizona too. I don't remember if you mentioned Arizona.
No, I didn't.
What about any in Oregon or Washington?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd come through out there.
Through Hermosillo.
Yeah.
And Monterrey, they would supply, what, the rest of Texas?
South Texas, yeah. And, you know, they use these guys up into Minnesota.
Right.
And pickle country up there, cherry picking season. And the harvest of different project.
Would the braceros be told where they were going?
No.
They just could end up...
We didn't tell them. We didn't know. Right. You know, we just kept a supply for them up here in this center, Rio Vista.
Right.
And it had people in it all the time. And the reverse happens, you know. Supposing you get a guy and they give him, fix up his I-100 for 6 months, and his 6 months is up. There's two options. They can be extended, this I-100 little car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as an immigration officer or border patrol, if they've got, and it's valid, you don't bother. Just check it. And but suppose no boy's done 6 months and that's all he wants to do. He ready to go home. Just tell them they'll pay for it. Bus him back to Rio Vista, process him for departure before he goes.
And back.
Yeah. It's a revolving wheel type thing.
Right.
So, well, I got very familiar with that before I'd retired. So this is one of the most interesting assignments that I had.
You mean the one in Chihuahua?
I'm getting ready to bring it up.
Oh, okay. So you were in Chihuahua for how many years? Do you remember, off and on?
Probably 10. Oh, but yeah. Just off and on.
Do you remember what years? From what years to?
I'm trying to think when the first time I went down there. It was all new to me and interesting. Oh, probably. That program. Probably in the 60s. I spent most of my time. I know that's right. Now, the exact year I can't tell you because I transferred. I was down at the port when I got sent down there several times.
Which port is that?
The Port of Entry, as an inspector down there. Mm-hmm. I did all the legal work for about 12 years.
Where was that? Which city?
Santa Fe Bridge.
Oh, this one, yeah, here in Santa Fe. Okay.
Because we've been here since 54.
I see.
And, of course, I've been retired about 16 years now. Makes you realize how old you are.
That would be, what, 87?
Me?
Right.
No, I'm approaching 80 in about 2 months.
Oh, I see. But you retired from the Border Patrol about 87?
No, in 84.
84? Okay.
They had a big party for you, and it was real nice. They give you a bunch of gifts.
Excuse me.
Tell a bunch of things about how good you are now.
So after the you were were not at the Chihuahua Center anymore.
Well, okay. I didn't never stayed down there longer than 3 or 4 months.
Right. But off and on you were there, and then you would come back here to El Paso at the port of entry.
To work is my, yeah.
There were still was there just the one bridge at the time?
No, we had the Isleta. I remember
that's
that.
Right.
I remember that. But I had some weird experience. Oh, here's one I wanted to tell you that I brought up earlier that I didn't get to tell. I think the phone took care of that. Actually, this old boy is a shirt-tail relative of ours that I'm getting ready to tell you about. Down at Pecos, his name was J.B. Kirkland. Nice guy. Used to be a pharmacist. I think he passed away just recently and moved to Austin. He retired. He was president of the Trans-Pecos Cotton Association there a while, and he knew his way around down in Austin.
Remember his name?
J.B. Kirkland.
Okay.
And he was a great guy and a very knowledgeable person. Good guy to work for. But one time, which is really not legal, but everybody did it, those farmers, of course, would have a nice home in Pecos. They have lawns and whatnot. Well, every once in a while they're lawn and they'd mow and they'd bring one of those braceros in, you know, and have him do the yard work. And old J.B. brought in an old boy one time to his home. His wife was there. And she knew he was going to bring a boy in to do the yard work that day. So he brought this old boy in and he told his wife, you know, I got John or Juan or whoever it was. And said he'll peck on the door when he needs to go to the bathroom, so you let him know, okay. And then old J.B. went back to the farm, out waiting to peck his way. Well, this old boy worked a while, and he pecked on the door, and she let him in, and had shown him where the bathroom was, you know. So he goes to the bathroom, closes the door, and he stays, and she got worried about him, but she didn't go in, she waited. So finally he come out, went on back out to the yard to go to work. And she's so concerned about his long stay, she went into the bathroom to see what he had done. And he didn't know what the commode was for, and he climbed up into the bathtub and took a crap.
Oh, no. He didn't know.
Oh, Jamie, you should tell that story. I said, you're a poor trainer, you are. You can't even guide him to the commode.
Gee.
But, of course, though, mentioned he... nothing modern in his life, he probably never saw one before.
They were probably used to the outhouses.
Yeah. But a lot of little things like that have happened over the years that were funny.
I'm curious, if we could go back to being in the prostate center in Chihuahua.
Mm.
Say if I was in the line and I would come up and say, you know, I want to be, what would you ask this person specifically?
Well, he's got an identity document that the Mexican Immigration Service issues him. Well, I'd look at it and I'd check the name and...
So they would have to begin with the Mexican Immigration first?
They've got, yeah.
And you check the name? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, no, no problem. And so then I gradually edge into this business about the previous experience as an agriculture worker. It doesn't have to be a cotton picker, but an agriculture worker. And then if you had any doubt, you'd look at their fingers and their hands. Some of those old boys' hands are tender like mine. Now, they're not agriculture workers.
So, but how would you try to, what kind of questions would you ask about?
Well, where you lived, how long you lived there, where's your family? What kind of work did you used to do? What are you doing now? And why aren't you working? No, you don't have a job now. Why? And how long do you intend to stay if you're accepted and passed? And does your family know you're up here? Mm-hmm. Does your family know that you're going on into the States, but you don't know where? Those kind of things. Just see what they'll say. And sometimes they'll come forth with some answers that'll snow you, you know. They're confused, and but most of the time they're so eager they overplay their hand. But I never did fall for any of that. It didn't bother me. I tried to do what was right by both them and the service. Mm-hmm. So that's what the you couldn't just walk in there with a blanket no on your face. But if we found somebody that would not fit the bill, another thing you'd do. Very important was we would dig into their criminal background. If they had much of a criminal background, we'd turn them down.
And that information would come from the Mexican authorities, I would assume.
Oh, we'd have to dig it out of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Mexican didn't fool them. And,
was that difficult to get the information?
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Yeah. They got on to the fact that that was one of the reasons they'd been turned down, and they'd lie about it. And you'd just keep digging, nudging a little here, nudging a little there, and if they've really been convicted, I'm not saying we were that good, but we could a lot of times we could tell.
How long would it take for you, say if you suspected somebody wasn't quite telling you the truth?
Well, I'd stay with them a little longer, 20, 30 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the decision then was usually like, I mean, you wouldn't keep somebody till the next day or anything, though? It was fairly quickly, more or less?
We had plenty to choose from.
I see.
And I'm sure there's some got through, and there's probably some that got through using somebody else's identity. They'd memorize it, you know.
Right. Any of them ever been rejected and would come back?
Yeah. They're pretty sharp. Some of those centers have 7,000 and 8,000, you know. People waiting to be interviewed, process. You know. They'd put them on a bus. I think they used a train some, but mostly a bus, and bus them to Juarez. And they'd bring them right to the port, and they'd have to come through American Immigration, and they had a little identity document to show you.
They would walk over?
Yeah, and then there'd be buses on this side. They'd take them to the release
time. Oh, I see.
Yeah, just load them up, just a relay type thing. And, of course, you could bribe those bus drivers. We would hear about it every once in a while. Some old boy get that far, and maybe even never intended to come into the States. He was playing the circle, you know.
System.
And he'd pay the bus driver, and they'd let him off over in Mexico before he brought him to the port.
So he just wanted to come to the border?
Yeah.
And then maybe try to get over as an illegal?
Yeah.
You think so?
Another thing interesting, I'm sure you...
Hold on. This is the second part of the interview with Mr. Ray Reeves on Wednesday, February the 19th, 2003, for the Bracero Oral History Project. The interviewer is Richard Baqueira. Okay, so we were talking about, oh yes, they would bring them over and sometimes they would bribe a driver to drop them off in Juarez.
Yeah, right.
A bus driver.
Yeah, because that wouldn't work after you come through here, you know.
Right,
come through here. Your port and get on them.
They count them, I would assume, right, and make sure that many got to the Rio Vista. Were you ever at the Rio Vista Center?
I've been there, but I've never worked there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know how they processed them and what they did. Well, it was always a busy place, coming and going, these farmers from all over the states that I mentioned, and I may have left some out, I'm not sure. But you like, if you had cherry picking season in Michigan, we've sent people to Michigan.
How would they get them there? Would they put them on a bus or train?
Yeah, put them on a bus. And if there's a big number, they, I think, furnish the buses. But usually they put them on a bus. The directions on how to get there and all. They wouldn't just turn them loose. But there's some of them. See, that's one of the weaknesses of the program is departure back to Mexico. You have no way of knowing when and if those guys all got back. And a lot of them were smart enough that while they were here as a bracero, they'd marry some U.S. citizen, and that gives them a legal maneuver to start their documents to live here. And my position in those kind of cases has always been legal. If this is legal, fine with me. If it's not legal, it's not fine with me. I'll get them. You
know? So there was no way to know. I mean, if somebody was in Michigan and their 6 months or whatever was up, they could just stay there and
disappear.
They could.
And I'm sure there's been a large number that have. Now, your files would show they're all kept in our offices here as far as this area is concerned. Yeah, the files would reflect Juan Montoya was in Grand Rapids, Michigan or something, but that still doesn't solve anything.
Right.
Because the only way you'd know is go where, go up to Michigan wherever this boy is supposed to be.
The rancher that they worked for would never say, okay, here's...
They didn't care. Now, a rancher is a little bit different than the farmer. The farmer had always had access to a lot of people. So they kept books on them and this sort of thing, and they'd have little rucuses and misunderstandings over pay and this sort of thing. But now the ranchers, they at first said, ah, this program's no good. I run on to someone I knew, a bunch of them down around Marfa, you know. Said, we have to take people that never saw a horse before and try to use him on our ranch. And that's true to a certain extent. I said, well, all you got to do is train them out. And when their time runs out, you can get them extended. Comes the bride. That can be done in, without bringing them back in. Again, like if you were in Colorado and your time was about up on your I-100, that can be done out in the field. Extend their I-100. And those people were very smart. Having to go back and face what they were facing, no jobs, the family was needy. I can see their angle. I never resented helping legally do anything. It's those illegals I'd get. And you'd get a criminal every once in a while in the review process. And just conversation, we were discussing before.
Okay.
They called one time, and this was down toward the end of my career, and they had a really big problem that they had to get resolved in a hurry. And they had brought in 800 Haitians that had come in the country illegally and put them in the federal penitentiary because there was no other place to put them. In and set up a program and got it all set up because they're entitled under the law. Regardless, they're here illegally, they're entitled to hearing it. So it's I set up machinery for all that and then told them I was ready for a judge and a U.S. attorney. And then they'd had a lot of trouble with this program, trying to get it off the road. And as you know, a lot of trouble with the Cubans at Atlanta and other places. Atlanta was the chief problem area. And they called me one day, my time was about up, and they said, you've done a real good job, and we're real impressed, and we need you in Atlanta. See if you can straighten out that mess down there. He said, we just had one big problem after another. Would you do it? I said, sure, I'll try. And things went real good, and I had about 70 employees down there. And I wound up being down there. I'd get to come back home every once in a while for a few days, but about 3 years in charge of it. It was a blast. I enjoyed that program a lot.
Quite a difference from
the
other.
Yeah, and we had a federal judge down there who didn't like immigration service, anybody in it. Had a U.S. attorney that's watching every time I sneezed. And our regional office in Dallas is doing the same thing. My central office in Washington is doing the same thing.
And so you were in Atlanta, right, you said?
And I was responsible for those people and my guys. See, our service never encountered a problem just like that before. So the law book didn't cover it. So they made your regulations as you went, and they explained all that to me. And I said, okay, just so you guys back me, if I needed backing, I'm going to take care of that. Okay, I'll go. So I'd pass some regulations as we'd go, and these guys that's working on that. We got along real good. Right, you're going to get in trouble. I said, no, I'm not going to get in trouble. I know what I'm doing. Yes, you are. You should do that. No, I said, hold on. Let's see how we come out. That's all they can do is correct me. I said, if they don't like the way I'm running this program, all they got to do is say so, and I'll be back in Texas tomorrow. It was a blast. It was a lot of fun running the program. Made a lot of friends and guys I never saw and never knew before. Then we got a few girls.
So how do you, overall, the Bracero program, did you think it was something that was necessary, something that was needed?
Well, at that time, definitely, because we had so many of our own people in the service gone.
Right.
And not enough was the best way to put it. Farm workers were available, so definitely wouldn't be needed. Today, I wouldn't support it as strong as I used to in those days, because our economy is bad. People are looking for jobs. And people will tell you that, oh, Americans won't bend over, they won't do that steep lift. They would if they're hungry. They have to, they will. And they're almost to that point, I guess.
Almost some areas. Like, yeah.
So I think my opinion can change a little depending upon the conditions of the country.
So you think that was the major, the most important thing about it? It was necessary.
Yeah.
And you mentioned before you thought one of the weaknesses was that it was difficult to keep track of them afterwards.
Yeah.
You think that's the major weakness? Any other?
Definitely it was.
Thing you would have liked to have changed?
I'd change that.
Anything else you would have liked to have changed about it?
All those areas you could improve on if you just take a certain area of the processing and speed it up, probably.
Okay.
Which really is insignificant. We always have plenty of manpower for whatever the country's needs.
The other thing I'm curious too is you mentioned how the braceros that you all approved in Chihuahua would be sent to Juarez. What about from Hermosillo? Where would they go?
Into California.
Through San Diego,
through the port down there.
In San Diego.
Hermosillo, I guess they'd probably go through, see that's south of...
maybe in Arizona?
Yeah, maybe they might have come out of there, I don't remember.
Okay, and do you know about, say, the ones down in Monterrey, would they have come in through Presidio or...
McAllen area.
McAllen, okay. Yeah,
Hidalgo or something. I never worked in the one in Monterey, nor the one in
Hermosillo.
No, just this one.
So the fact that you ended up at the center in Chihuahua was, they asked you, I'm sure because of your experience, right? You knew Spanish, and so it was no accident that.
No,
you ended up there.
No, I was fair to them, but they had to measure up, or I wouldn't give them. I wouldn't. There's no boy. I used to sit on our hiring boards when we get new applicants for the job. Certain procedures.
For the Border Patrol?
There's a certain procedure they'd go through, and they'd have to go before this board. Who would, that's before they was hired, it's part of the hiring process, who would interview the candidate and ask him a bunch of questions, try to test his judgment and all of that sort of thing. And
I enjoyed that. You're really delving into a guy's thinking processes in an interview like that.
For a kind of job like that, I would think you'd have to.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah. I enjoyed it. One old boy one time, I just kind of had him sized up before we got very far along. We had three members of these panels. And I guess we were in Atlanta. And he was a sergeant on police force somewhere in Alabama. And you could tell he was, you know, Mr. Somebody, just the way he acted and talked. So I thought, well, let's see about that. So I began to needle him a little here and there. But he looks at me and he says, I hope someday that you're sitting on this side of the table and I'm sitting on another. And I said, son, that'll never be. And you know,
you got to him, huh?
Yeah, I got to him. I wouldn't think you could. You sure could. Mm-hmm. And that's what those hiring boards are all about.
Would somebody like judgment. That, would you pass somebody like that, or no. Would you? No.
I turned this guy down. This is a strange story. The other two board members, nobody ever gets offended about anything like that. So, Ray, we think with his experience as a police officer that he'd make us a hand. And we think we ought to vote for him. And I said, sure. If you feel that way, I'd do that. I don't feel that way, and I'm not going to vote for him. But don't let my opinion sway you, because yours is not going to sway me. He laughed. He's all good-natured, you know. Well, they hired that guy, and you can guess where they stationed him, Las Cruces. And he ended up there 2 weeks till people began asking headquarters, where'd that guy come from? He's causing all kinds of trouble. Wonder who hired him.
He should have listened to you, huh?
Yeah.
What do you think of the Border Patrol today?
Well,
how has it changed?
Oh, it's changed a lot. The guys tell me, Ray, you better be glad you're out. But when they brought up this business of splitting service, you're aware of that?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, and Congress is just finishing it.
Oh, see, you mean the Homeland Security thing?
Right. Okay. We used to be, of course, all one service, Immigration and Border Patrol. When we were considered Enforcement Division, Immigration was considered Administrative Division. And they just got bogged down. And it should have been taken care of 10, 15 years ago. And I'm told that on some of those, well, we'll use Philadelphia, for instance, or Chicago, for some of those big offices, that they're just stacks of applications where people would apply for this or apply for that, and they have to be interviewed and approved and this and that and the other. And they've laid there for 6, 8, maybe not a year, with no attention. And that shouldn't be that way. We should have better service than that. And I was kind of glad. I was for the splitness.
I see.
Provided, not just some political appointee, don't put him ahead of it, provided you get some qualified people that's doing
some run the thing.
Yeah. That was my comment when they was telling me that. I said, no, I've got to go for it because we haven't done a real good job as a service. And I said, the Enforcement Division's done a better job than some of these others have.
Do you think that it's gotten the job, well, I would think it's more difficult these days, but with having to deal with people dying out in the desert, people getting in railroad cars, and you never had, or did you? Did you have?
Oh, yeah, but not as profound as it is today, I don't think. Yeah, we would do. See, I was in charge of our smuggling program here for 8 years. We'd catch these coyotes, we call them. They'd catch these coyotes in so many different ways of trying to smuggle illegals into the country back off the border. Right. And it was kind of a cat and mouse game, you could say. And it was a lot of fun. And it was while you encounter someone, but pretty honored, pretty neat. And that's the weak part of the whole program, not necessarily Marcel, but you might handle 10, 15, 100 of the illegals in a month or more. All of them are just the old Marcel type. Well, it's coming looking for a job. My family's hungry. You don't blame them. I do.
Right.
And then the next guy would be with a knife. I got one right there.
Really? I was going to ask you if you ever had any.
Yeah.
Dangerous experiences, let's say.
Quite a few.
Really?
One time I jumped in a real isolated area. I had a good partner, but I had to sign him. I was in charge. I'd sign him down on the river, and I was about 200 yards off the river. And I told him, I said, I'm going to raid that house at 8 o'clock. Get yourself ready. Let's don't lose any of it. And this house was a puzzle. And I was going to try to find out what pieces were here, because it was in a field where there was no cultivation of any kind, and yet activity galore.
Hmm.
And in those days, they were smuggling this Candelia wax. You've heard of that, I'm sure.
No.
I'll explain it to you in a minute. And they had smuggled, so I raided this house. And as I walked in, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a stack of rifles, and I knew I was in trouble by myself.
Yeah.
And I looked out, and I had it in my hand. And I told the Spaniards, I told anybody, if you are, you're dead. I'll kill everyone. And there's a way I bluffed my way out, and I got them all for it by myself. And there have been some other instances like that. And you just got to be alert.
Right. What were they doing there? Did you ever figure?
Smuggling that wax. Now, what that wax is, it's a very valuable product. It grows on a plant that grows about yay high.
About a couple of feet?
Yeah. It only grows in hot, arid regions. And it's stemmy, about like the stems in the mop paddle. No flowers, no nothing, just stems. And you take that wax and pull it, the whole plant, and they take it into these, we call them pilas, P-I-L-A-S. And they were barrels cut in half, built over a pit. And they put fire into this pit and fill those barrels with sulfuric acid, or not fill them, but put sulfuric acid in with water at a certain portion they use. And you put this weed in there, and you cook the wax off of the weed. Put it in hot, and then you pull the cooked plant out, use it for fodder, firewood, or nothing, the wax would solidify. And I've seen them ship it out to Presidio by the carload, train carload, over the back east, St. Louis, and back in there.
Yeah,
and they make plastics out of it.
Oh, okay.
So it's a ready market all the time.
What did you say it was? Candelia?
Yeah.
Wax. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's a big project down in the Presidio area.
Why couldn't they just import it legally? This was just...
I was going to get
that. Oh, okay.
Excuse me. They had... let me see. I wanted to tell this right. Any merchandise or anything that's brought across a land border or a border that hasn't been brought through customs is illegal contraband.
I see.
So Mexican customs wouldn't let that be legally brought in, but the U.S. customs would. So what would happen after? First, it was a wild, woolly game. Guns, gunpowder. I've been involved in some of that. And later, it kind of readjusted to where if you could get it through, get it on the American side, and take it directly to the nearest port and declare it, it'd be legal.
I see.
But you had to smuggle it down away from the Mexicans to do it. And last I knew, it was still that way. So you had a going battle with them all the time.
How valuable was it, do you know?
Pretty valuable. I can't tell you.
And obviously enough to where they do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big chance.
It's just hard
they
to believe.
They killed a guy one time. My partner and I were the first ones in this place. Right in Presidio one night, a Jewish fellow. And he owned a big gun. A furniture warehouse type thing, furniture store. And I didn't know he was involved in it, but I sure did. And they said more that morning that somebody called us and said, you better get out of there, it's a problem. And somebody found him and they'd taken him down in the basement and taken a 12-inch bolt and tied him to a chair and beat him to death.
Mm.
And we got to looking around and trying to figure out a motive, and we found it. Little tiny flakes of the Candelia wax at the back door, and horse
footprints, footprints. They brought them over horseback, you know. I guess they got hassling over the price or something and just killed them.
I've never heard of that wax. It's interesting.
It's still in existence. But it'll only grow in a hot, like Arizona. I mean, we've got some out there. But we've got a lot more.
Well, you had your notes. I wonder if have we talked about it.
Yeah, I think we did. We should have covered it.
Do you want to go ahead and look them over before I...
Okay.
Oh, they had sent us, especially the younger people. I don't think the age had anything to do with it. And the Border Patrol, then when I first went in, they'd send us what we call detail. And they had, like if I stationed at Presidio and they needed some help, they was getting flooded up at Fabens, which happened. Or out in California, which happened. And I enjoyed those trips. You know, you'd be gone 60 or 90 days, and she'd nearly always come after a day or two.
Your wife?
Yeah, after I'd find us a place to live. I'd go with the gang first, and after we'd settle in somewhere, well, she'd come out. Our little old boy, the guy that's a lawyer now, he was about that big. Well, she brought him to Chihuahua one time. And everywhere I go, it seemed like I have a different experience. He got a digestive problem down there. He'd cough up his food, you know. And so we took him to a doctor. I inquired out to this center where I was working. People that lived there were a good doctor. And they said there's a good German doctor there. So I took him to him. And I think that's what he diagnosed him. And he says, my nurse will be out to your cabin and give him a shot or something. And here are the pills he's supposed to take. They're about the size of a quarter. And that old guy was about 2 years old. And I said, looked it out. And I said, and he's supposed to swallow that? Yeah. And I said, oh, let's put all this on hold and I'll call you. I need you. I got up and walked out. I said, I must owe you. So I told her, and I said, you better take him and get him back to the States. Well, we know what we're doing. We don't know what we're doing. It's too dangerous to play with. And she brought him to a doctor here. She brought him up here to El Paso. Whatever it was, he got all right. But those are things you learn the hard
way. Yeah, that's right. You probably were safer, maybe. And certainly you felt better about doing that.
Oh, definitely. But she's one time they sent us with a bunch of equipment out to California. I had a lot of fun on that assignment. And we drove the Jeeps and some trucks out there. So I told her, I said, I'll call you when we get where we're going and I find us a place to live. So I checked in at El Centro, about dark. They said, we need you down at Calexico, about 12, 15 miles. And he was right on the line. I said, okay, I'll go down there and report. And I walked in down there, and the radio operator says, are you Mr. Reeves? And I said, yeah. How do you know? He said, we got a call for you. Pick it up the phone. It was her. She's already there.
Oh.
She was in El Centro trying to find me.
All right.
Kind of funny.
That was quick work.
Yeah. But she took another patrol agent's wife to Pecos and left her. That's where she wanted to go. And then headed with our son to Central. And she was traveling faster than we were. Because it took us about a day and a half. It took her just a day.
Wow.
She made it from Pecos out there to about
dark. That's pretty good.
Doggone right. That little old boy, we used to laugh about it. Of course, he's a great big guy now. He's 6'4", big man. But I had a little hassock, you know what they are. And she had said it.
I think they call them like an ottoman, something small.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she had set that right in the seat beside her. That's where he wanted it. And he had sit right by his mother wherever they wanted. Yeah. If I was in the car, he'd get in the back seat and go to sleep. Why wouldn't he be right there by his mother? We used to laugh at that. He just let a little shit. He was a real thin kid until he was grown, and he filled it up. But we've had a lot of wild experiences and a lot of fun.
I was going to say, it sounds like you enjoyed most of it.
Oh, yeah. I had a blast.
Was there anything that you could, other than maybe the danger?
Oh, I'm in a few scrapes, you know. Yeah. I'm sure you don't want to record this one, and I'll brief it, otherwise I could talk to them about dark on this one. You know where our museum is?
Yeah, over here at the...
Bill and Sue Turner were very active and instrumental in the establishment of that museum. And they had a cabin up at Cloudcroft, and they had, it was two-story, and every once in a while they'd invite four or five couples up there. You know.
I mean, this is a story you were telling me a while ago about Mr. Dwyer.
Well, that's it.
Yeah. That's it. I'm curious, do you think the Border Patrol these days has their image with the public? Do you think it's the correct one? Is it wrong? Because some people see the Border Patrol maybe in a not a very good light.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, it's probably because somewhere down the line they've had an encounter with the patrol for some reason or other, and they didn't like the outcome of it, or maybe the patrolman wasn't courteous enough, or considered enough. Right. The public expects things that you can't do for them as a Border Patrol. And that upsets some people. I know one night I was working in port, because we'd always had problems down there, still do. This old boy, the law states that a NATO officer just has to identify himself only. And you can admit him, pass him. Anybody else, they've got to have the documents, passport, what they call I-94, the permit, and all. Well, he showed up with his car and his family and his wife and all, and his two children. Well, nobody brought their passports. Well, I could admit him, but I could admit them. So, well, they're at the base, they're at our house. I said, well, don't doubt that, but I said, we have to see those documents before we. And they go, he didn't like that. So I think he was a Dutchman, I'm not sure. No. He started cursing me. I said, now wait a minute. I said, you're not going to curse me. I don't know what you're saying, but I know you're cursing me. I said, you're going to get your butt thrown in the jail in a few minutes if you don't hush. I said, I've treated you nice, I'll continue to treat you nice, but don't you do that. I don't know whether he understood what I told him or not. Probably did. I didn't get talked to like that anymore.
So when you retired, what were you? Were you just...
I was assistant chief. Okay. When I was at the port, I was down there about 14 years. I had a job I really liked, and I had a good boss, a good guy in charge of the port. He was an Irishman out of New York. He was a good guy to work for. He liked to enforce the law. And if you want to get on his bad side, just be lazy. If you work, he liked you. And I used to set up all of our cases and take all the sworn statements, all that business. And these immigration judges, they got to know me pretty well. Every once in a while, some lawyer, we defending the case down there, and they'd call me in as a witness, you know. And the judge would say, when I walked in, said, Mr. Reed, look, Mr. So-and-so here, doubts your ability to translate this interview you had with his client in Spanish. And he said, would you mind telling the court how you acquired your knowledge of Spanish? I did. Because I never did finish that long ago. Finally, when I come in here, transferred in here with 54 from Presidio, I talked to him in the front office down there and talked him into letting me stay off the 4-12 shift. I worked some extra midnight to 8 shifts so I could go to night school. I had 100 hours and I wanted to finish, and she wanted to finish. And I finally got it, but boy, it was tough. And she did a couple of history courses, and she did all of them. I took them out of Texas Tech.
Oh, so you have a degree?
Yeah, I got one. I didn't get very easy.
Bachelor's?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good.
Yeah, so I got it in languages. So the old judge, he knew what was coming. He'd get a big kick out of it. You know, have trouble keeping his face straight. So he'd start off, you know, "Now, Mr. East, would you tell the court about your knowledge of Spanish?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, BS, agent Spanish." "You do?" And he'd heard it, you know. I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Do you use it?" "Oh, yeah, I use it every day." "How many years have you been speaking Spanish?" "Why, this old defense attorney." We had a lot of trouble with that.
That settled that question, huh?
Yeah, I take care of it.
Well, is there anything else you'd...
No, I've told you a lot of wild tales, I guess.
Excuse me.
Let's see. Well, I was going to tell you about these details, we call it. You know, you get sent to California.
Right.
I got sent to Fabens one time from Presidio, and that was a fun job. I'll tell you one, something that happened one time just a minute. I was down in the lower valley at Raymondville there by Kingsville. King Ranch there for a while one time. Oh, here's something kind of funny. They'd get these braceros on these farms like down to Pecos, several thousand of them. And among that group, you get some Tuffies and some Betty Acres and somebody that wouldn't work and so on. So they had a kind of a mini strike going on this farm. They had several hundred workers in the area. And they called this big meeting, and they were really bashing the service and bashing the contract. All of them were given a contract, mm-hmm. putting their little hand in Spanish. And so it looked like it was going to turn into a riot. So they called the sheriff's office, and the old Texas Ranger was sitting there. I knew him pretty well. He said, "I'll take care of that." And there was a Mexican vice consul out on this farm agitating it, you know, telling them how they'd been mistreated and all that baloney. The old ranger went out there and got that Mexican consul and threw him in jail.
Oh, really? I guess that was the end of that.
That was the end of that. We had no more trouble.
Did you ever see the contract? How much were they usually paid?
No, the going wage.
For?
And then some of it was like today, and they's doing it in those days. Maybe they pay more today than they did in those days. Like you pick tomatoes, you got a pail or container, and they weigh it, and you're paid by the pound that you pay.
I see. And the cotton is paid by the pound as well. Right. Okay.
No doubt, some dishonesty went on both sides, but we weren't involved in that.
I see. The
only thing we were involved in was any demonstrations or problems of that nature. But
what would happen if you had, say, if you had someone who, I don't know, assaulted another bracero? Who would
turn to the sheriff?
The sheriff, the local sheriff would.
Yeah. In instances where something like that has happened, right at first the civil authorities, boy, they'd pop them, you know, and give them a pretty good sentence. And then it turns out that they's filling every vacancy all over the country with these people, and you and I as taxpayers would have to pay the bill. So then they resorted, nobody put this together, but it's just a matter of practice. They resorted to give them suspended sentences so they can turn them over to immigration then. And that's the best way. You just put them in jail for a long time because, just like you said, big experience.
Then they probably let them loose and...
Oh, yeah. I can tell you a deal that make your hair curl. You know, I told you about that deal. Atlanta on the Cubans.
Right.
Well, we'd have these hearings because there's entitled to a hearing a year. We started out with 2,300 of those rascals, because old Castro just made a monkey out of old President Carter. Carter's the one that says, "Come on over, we'll help you, send anybody, and we'll take them." And the first thing he did was clean out his prisons.
Prisons, I remember that, yes.
And we still got them. Probably didn't know this. And there's a criteria that they have to meet in these hearings before you can make a decision to release them. And a since a bunch of those buddies haven't made that criteria yet, and because they've had so much trouble and torn up and set fire to, you know.
So you mean they're still in a prison?
Yeah.
Oh.
They sprinkle them all over the United States, a few here, a few young, a few in the federal prisons. And they're still there. That's here at my expense. Hmm. Now, that shouldn't be. That should be resolved instead of hitting the taxpayers like that.
Right.
And what's it going to accomplish? Nothing. And that's Attorney General's business. Uh-huh. But because I actually was working out of his office, I was running because he was in charge of that program. But I never was in agreement with that. There should be a better disposal made of that type of individual. I used to say, I tell you what I can do. What do you do, Ray? I said, let's load up that bus with a bunch of these monkeys, these toughies, and take them down to old Carter's house in Georgia.
Well, you think they could have put them on a plane and sent them back to Cuba or something.
We had that arranged one time while I was down there. We were going to take two plane loads back. And I wanted to go. I thought that'd be quite a thing, quite an experience. And had them all selected, had the planes ready to go and everything. Old Costco canceled it. Hmm.
Of course, he wouldn't want to.
No. No, it's a...
Well, is there anything else that you...
No, man, that's about got it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I wanted to give you a chance to...
Yeah. Well, just let me run some items that I think we've covered them all. A kind of a review here. I commented that the Bracero program helped local economies wherever they were, and they have, because they spent a lot of the money that they've worked and earned and sent a lot of it to Mexico, of course, and helps their economy and to their families down there, and it's caused some law enforcement problems because they get drunk and raise the devil, you know. And then I contend that they have taken jobs that legals and local people wanted and needed, and more so today than way back before. Yeah. And I don't think this has been a big problem, but diseases from Mexico. I know there's been some of that, but not big.
So you think they could have screened them a little better, maybe, when they came over?
Yeah,
medically?
Of course. You know, like where I described what the screening process that I've been involved in, so we didn't have to do the medical.
Right.
And neither did anybody else. They could have sick or something else. Mm-hmm. You'd never know it talking to them.
Right.
And I personally don't want to have them. Yeah. And then I mentioned intermarriages with U.S. citizens. And you can't blame them. That's legal.
Right.
So, but there was a lot of that. We've got an investigative arm in the service that investigates problems within the border in the country, and there's been a lot of fraudulent marriages. Supposing you had a daughter who's 20 years old, and I'm a bracero and I'm 22, and I'm looking for some way to stay in the States when my contract expires, my I-100 expires. Well, I get my eye on her, and first thing you know, I've learned that if you're married to an American citizen, your chances of staying are pretty good. And then your chances of arranging your papers are good. So I marry your daughter, and a week later I say, adios, I'm going to California. Nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you can prove that the marriage as an investigator for the service was by fraud just for the purpose of getting your papers, then you got him. He's going to be deported.
Can.
Yeah, you can do that.
Is that difficult to prove?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's not that easy because you're saddled with who do you believe, which story do you believe. Now, a woman by nature would be probably a little abusive and extravagant with her language. I don't like him, he done me dirty, vengeance type approach. And right in the middle, there's where you are.
Right.
You get this old boy, you know, do that.
Right.
So it's not easy. We leave that up to the immigration judges. That's their business.
See.
Well, I spoke of the fact that we always were encountering workers who presented themselves to us in those screening processes to be agriculture workers when they're not.
Right.
Or hadn't been. And I mentioned a few agitators and communists that we would encounter. And then they're sent to these big cities, and some of them have just a little moxie, like they're sent to Minneapolis, because I know they have a lot of pickles up in there.
Right.
And they're not just pulling those pickles and looking without looking around. The first thing you know, they disappear. And this country's full of illegals. And the one thing that bothers me, I think we've got a bunch of communists in right now. Because I used to come home when I worked at port, I used to come home and complain to her, and this is 20 years ago, or more. I said, oh, it's too lax, it's too lax. And the only time you get in trouble is when you stop somebody.
It's almost by accident that you would catch someone.
Yeah, or you don't stamp the document like they ask you to be. And first thing you know, they've got you on the carpet. Why not? What do you see wrong with that? You know, that sort of thing. You get into a lot more trouble trying to enforce the law in those days than most people, as you know. They do now. But I'm really confident in saying that we've got a lot of terrorists in this country. And we may have to pay the bills on these days.
I think what happened a year ago, September, kind of proves it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those, see how the immigration had bungled all of that?
Oh, yes.
They even sent them an extension after that.
After it happened.
One of the pilots. God, that's awful.
That's pretty
now, our service should be better than that. If we've got people that can't do the job, get rid of them, get somebody that will. I'm a believer in doing it right.
Sure. Because you've got responsibility, not just to yourself, but to
human, to people.
Yeah.
Be courteous, be nice, which I've tried to do. Only one time I ever got in trouble that way. You had to look out on a Catholic priest. He's for big enough. I was working down at the port. One Sunday afternoon, here he comes, car, and I looked at that, had a picture of him. I looked at my own name, asked him. So I was very polite. I asked him to step out. I said, well, we need to go down to the office a minute. So I tell you, a friend would park the vehicle away. Well, he was steamed up already, you know. And I wouldn't let him see the lookout. It wasn't none of his business anyway. And so he started to go downstairs in the old building. And he reached over and tried to tear my badge off. I shoved him. And boy, when that got all written up on his side. Well, they had a big investigation on old Ray Reeves about mistreating the Padre. And, well, the old boy I was working with was a Mexican-American guy named for Customs, Chavez. And after it was all over, the guy did the investigations. Of course, they cleared. I hadn't done anything real wild or wrong.
Right.
He said, Ray, if you ever get in trouble, you get Mr. Chavez to be with you. He said, man, he thinks you're great. I said, well, that's good. And he said, he sure helps you in this investigation. He said, well, we weren't trying to pin anything on you. We just tried to establish the facts. And he said, we didn't have to go very far after we talked to him. Because he stood there and looked and saw it all. I said, well, I didn't mistreat the old guy. I said, he mistreated me.
You were, he was under investigation for bigamy, you said?
Bigamy.
Really? And he was a priest?
Right.
Okay.
That was what the lookout said.
Okay.
I don't know what happened to that case. I should have checked it. And then his name was Father Acosta. I'll never forget it.
He was from here in El Paso?
Yeah. And one time we went to Coastal Little League here for 14 years. And one of my players had a wedding in his family. They were going to have the wedding out here at this Catholic church in Smeltertown.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, can you come, Mr.? I said, yeah, we'll be there. So we came, and rooster in the wind and this sort of thing, you know. So the same guy, Captain Father Costa, was handling the services.
Hmm.
And directly he recognized me.
he stopped the service and he passed that little deal with the handle on it for money, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't forgetting old Ray Reeves. No.
Well, you hadn't forgotten him either. Well, again, anything?
No, that's most of it, I guess.
Okay. Then this will conclude the interview with Mr. Reeves.